Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
Welcome to Outdoor Explorer. Arctic Alchemy is a new documentary featuring Roman Dial and his life spent in the outdoors, including his work studying resting rivers in the Arctic. Roman started in Alaska as a youth, visiting his uncle in Healy and barely looked back. He became a world-class alpine mountaineer and helped popularize winter biking with his Hell biking expeditions. He then started pack rafting as part of the Alaska Wilderness Classic races, eventually writing one of the first how-to books on the sport. All the while helping raise two children with his wife Peggy, teaching at Alaska Pacific University, and doing applied research ranging from the tropics to the Arctic. He joins me, your host Paul Tordat, to discuss the film and his new work studying the mystery of Alaska's resting rivers. Stay tuned for Outdoor Explorer. Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host Paul Tordat, and I have Roman Dial with me in the studio, and we are discussing the new documentary Arctic Alchemy that features Roman. Welcome back to the show, Roman.
Thanks, Paul. Good to be here.
Yeah, so tell us a bit about this documentary, how it came about, and a little overview of it.
Sure. You know, I usually don't like to do films or TV shows. I've been involved with a bunch of them, and I really never liked the way they came out. They never seemed to be a good record of what I'd experienced. It was a story that the producers or the directors, somebody else wanted to tell a story, and it was usually a story that I didn't recognize. There was a young filmmaker up here doing a film on, a doctor and skier and kayaker named Paul Forward, who's an amazing bow hunter. And I was asked to participate for one day, and I met this guy, Colin, young guy, early 30s, and he was like the best film director I'd ever worked with. I mean, he didn't make me do, he never said, hey, that was great, can we do it again?
Oh, nice, yeah.
Yeah, and so I didn't really think much more of it. And then he approached me and said, you know, I like this research that you're doing, because Paul had told him about it, this research up in the Brooks Range. And he said, well, I'd like to make a film about the research that you're doing up there, and I can, you know, get some funding to get us up there. And I thought that was great, because I was running out of funding, and there's a lot of rivers up there that still need to be sampled, these wild and scenic rivers like the Salmon River. We'd sampled that, and the Alatna River, we had money to sample that. That's a wild and scenic river. But then there's the John River, which is actually, you know, a more important river in many ways. So he said he was able to find some funding from the Sierra Club to go do some research, and he was going to make this film about the research we were doing on these what they call rusting rivers, where, you know, the permafrost is thawing and the rivers are turning color and poisonous, basically, and or toxic, I guess would be the better word. So I agreed to it, but it ended up being a lot more than just us doing research. It ended up covering a lot of other aspects of my life that I didn't anticipate and I didn't ask for. I kind of didn't really, I was a little put off by it. I didn't want it to be just about me. I wanted it to be more about the research, but, you know, it came out, I like it, and I mean, it's the only TV show or film I've ever been involved with that I wanted my mom to see.
Oh, that says a lot right there. Yeah, and it's now, we'll have links on the Outdoor Explorer website, but it's now available to stream at the LA Times Shorts webpage. So let's go from there. We'll come back to the film a bit. Talk about the research, and what I'd like to have you do is sort of go a little bit about like where you started with the research, how you got into it, why you're interested. You've reinvented yourself a lot of times. You've been an alpinist, you've been a biker, sort of the whole hell biking thing. You did pack rafting, but on this other, you know, sort of other like maybe paths in lives, you raised a family, and you had this career as a scientist and teacher. So let's talk about the scientist and the teacher part of it.
Okay.
And like how you got into it, why you got into it, and sort of the sequence of how one sort of project led to another. That's a lot there, but let's just start with how you got into research.
Sure. Great question, Paul. I wanted to be a scientist from a very early age. To be honest with you, I can't really remember my life before I was 9. And 9 years old is when I came to Alaska for the first time. And it was such a mind-blowing experience. It just sort of crushed any previous memories I have. But I do know that even before, you know, I'd come to Alaska, I was interested in nature, and I spent a lot of time walking around in the woods and at farms and things. And I was kind of a precocious kid, and I wanted to be like a herpetologist and an ornithologist and a mammalogist. And so I wanted to be a scientist, and I did scientific trips as a kid that my parents indulged me in. But as puberty came, I kind of lost the interest in science, and I became more interested really like in adventurous things and girls, you know, and
but sort of similar, you know, but yeah.
They are, yeah. And then you know what happened? I did that for many years. You know, I lived in Fairbanks, and then, you know, started a family, and then I needed to go back to college. You know, I got a couple of degrees, but I needed to go get a graduate degree so I could become a scientist, you know, and I went to Stanford and got the PhD. And my research there, this kind of getting to your question, combined sort of the climbing skills that I had developed with, you know, experimentation in ecology. So I worked in rainforest canopies in the Caribbean. And Carl Tobin, who'd been my climbing partner for many years, he came down and helped me set this experiment up. So I set up these experiments in treetops. And it was really exciting to kind of mix my outdoor skills with sort of bumping nature through experimentation to see how it reacted, and then learning a lot about like what's going on, because I still am fascinated by nature itself, you know. So anyway, that kind of launched me on a career of mixing outdoor skills with scientific questions. And once I was at APU, which was, you know, we met there.
Yep.
And that was a perfect home for me. You know, I loved being there. I loved the students. I liked almost all the faculty I ever worked with.
Yep.
And I found that I was encouraged by people like you, for example, to kind of continue to do outdoor stuff with students, and then I could fold in scientific questions. So I did research in the canopy with students. Then I did glaciology, where we went up on ice fields like the Harding Ice Field and the Aklutna Glacier to collect data about ice worms and algae. And then Patty Sullivan at the University of Alaska Anchorage, whom I'd done some projects, we'd shared graduate students, he said, hey, why don't we put together a proposal to do work in the Brooks Range, where he'd been working for a decade or two. And I said, yeah, I love the Brooks Range. And so that launched a whole nother piece of the career for me, the scientific side. And by then I was kind of old, but I was into pack rafting and hiking still, you know, not whitewater pack rafting, but hiking. And I was teaching statistics, and it was awesome because APU is a great school. It has these little classes, and I would teach statistics. And, you know, I think you were, for the outdoor studies program, you and Dave McGivern were two of the driving forces that you know, made that a requirement that the outdoor OS students would take a statistics class. And it was awesome, yeah. You know, like to have OS students in there. And I would find the OS students, or, you know, ES-OS double majors who were good in statistics and had good outdoor skills, and I'd pluck them out and say, hey, would you like to go to the Brooks Range next summer for, you know, field work?
Yeah. And then what, I think a lot of research and sort of insight comes from serendipity. So talk about like how one project, particularly the tree line study, sort of led to the Rusted River.
Yeah, thing. Sure. Sorry about, yeah. Well, I got those students started on the tree line work. You know, the two that really stand out are Russell Wong and Julia Ditto, who, you know, who were in there for quite a bit of the tree line work. And the tree line work, Patty had the idea that, you know, we would fly into these remote airstrips between Canada and Kivalina, you know, all the way across the Brooks Range. We had like 20 of them, and fly in with Super Cubs. He called it his Super Cub proposal, but I wanted to walk from study site to study site so that I could develop intuition about, you know, what's going on. I wanted to see everything, you know, and feel it, so I had a better understanding of how things worked rather than just dropping in on an airplane. And so we did that in 2019. We went from the Hall Road to Canada. And then in 2020, which was the COVID year, we we walked from the Hall Road. There was a bunch of students there because they'd all lost their jobs, and I created a little bubble that they could be inside working on shrubs around here. Excuse me. And so we, some of them, you know, we walked out to the Aragetch Peaks, which is like a couple hundred miles away. And on our way out there and back, we walked and pack rafted. And on our way out there, we would run into all these streams that I'd seen before, because I've been going up to the Brooks Range since 1979. And in 1986, I'd walked across the same piece of the Brooks Range. And lo and behold, there were these streams that you couldn't drink. They would curdle your milk, and like the clear river. It wasn't clear anymore. You know, it was kind of milky and orange, greenish, really. And it would curdle your milk, and it tasted awful. And I sent these two young men, Toshio and Alan, and looking around to find clear water, and they couldn't find any, you know? Mm-hmm. And this was like the first time I'd ever encountered that. And then the next day, we walked past an orange waterfall, and we found clear water, and we tasted it. It was like battery acid, you know? So that really got me wondering, you know, what in the world is going on? Because for the next month, we would have certain days where we had trouble finding water. It was 2020. It was a really hot summer, so we had trouble finding drinking water in a place that I'd... For, you know, 20 years, 30 years before that, I would just drink any water, anywhere, anytime.
Mm. Wow. And so that triggered your sort of scientific brain.
Yeah,
your,
and I wanted to know what was going on.
Why.
And here's the weird thing. It was water. I've never really been interested in water except to go rafting. And it was obvious that it had to do with permafrost. And I'd always wanted to ignore permafrost because it was below ground and you can't really figure out or visualize it without imagining it. And so here was something that obviously had to do with water and permafrost and geology, you know, because it had to have some rock or wetlands. These were all topics, you know, hydrology, you know, permafrost, geology, chemistry. These were the four scientific disciplines I had never had any interest in over my entire scientific career, you know, since the 1980s. Yeah. And now all of a sudden they were super fascinating. And so that launched me in a direction for several years to figure out what was going on. But it was seeing this, like having, like not being able to drink water. I mean, that's pretty fundamental. So I wanted to know what's causing this.
Yeah. And the documentary talks about all this. So I encourage people to watch it. What did you find? So you went back, apparently. You've been going back and looking at these rivers now for a while.
Yeah. Right? And, you know, that's the other really, really super cool part about doing science like this is, you know, to be able to spend a month walking around in the Brooks Range, looking closely at it, paying attention to it, not just like, which way should we go? Or isn't that view pretty? But, you know, what's this and what's going on and the big picture and actually collecting data and recording it. And, so what it's turned out to be, and then coming back and looking at the data, because a lot of times what's happening isn't clear until you've got it on your computer and you're making graphs of it. And then once you make graphs of it and you start writing about it, then you're like, oh, wow, I see what's going on. And then you read other papers and you connect it to the body of literature. And all of a sudden, you're like, all these light bulbs are going on, like, you know, Christmas light bulbs. Like, it's colorful amazing, you know, and very exciting. So what I've learned in this particular case is that it's the combination of the geology and the permafrost thaw. So the permafrost is thawing pretty rapidly, and there's this thing called an active layer. So when you're in a permafrost area, the ground freezes solid from the surface all the way down to the permafrost. And the permafrost is the permanently frozen ground that's frozen for 2 years or more in a row. And in the winter, everything's frozen. And then the summer comes along, and then it thaws out down to the permafrost layer. They have some word for it. I don't know what it is, but down to the permafrost layer. But some years, the active layer is deeper than others. Mm-hmm. And that happens when you have sort of a relatively warm winter with a lot of snow, so the permafrost doesn't get that cold, followed by a warm summer. And then when that active layer thaws down to a place where it hasn't thawed in 1,000 years or more, then rock is thawed, because permafrost isn't just like frozen water, it's just frozen ground. So it could be solid rock without a like drop of water.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Huh.
Yeah, and that would be permafrost.
Yeah.
So that rock has been protected from liquid water because it was frozen. But now the active layer is down there at the rock and water gets to it, and it's oxygenated water, water that has oxygen in it, and it, when it hits pyrite, which is fool's gold, the fool's gold is iron with a sulfur. And when this oxygenated water hits it, it breaks apart. And the iron can now, well, let me talk about the sulfur breaks apart and forms sulfuric acid. And when the sulfur breaks apart and forms the sulfuric acid, this acidity allows the iron to travel through the water. Because iron is usually like, you know, it's like metal. You know, it doesn't move. Yeah. It's like a iron rod. But now it can move through the water. And then once it connects with water that's not so acidic, then it rusts out. You know, it forms a rust and it precipitates is the chemical word. So that's what we found is you need sort of two things. You need the right kind of rock, rock that has these, what they call metal sulfides. So the most common metal sulfide is pyrite or fool's gold, which is an iron sulfide. That's why all these rivers and streams turn orange or red. And then you need to have thawing permafrost. And so a lot of the Brooks Range has these metal sulfides. And these are all things I just learned. So, of course, I'm really excited about them, you know. And, like, and I, you know, I think I had a geology class and they said, you know, at the bottom of the ocean millions of years ago, hot water came up that was sort of affected by the magma in the Earth's core. And that has metals in it. And then that's super deep in the ocean, you know, like thousands of feet down. And that water, that brine, they call it, this hot water with metals in it, you know, iron and zinc and lead, maybe gold, I don't know, but certainly iron, zinc and lead, copper, arsenic, all these metals kind of come bubbling up. Like if you see pictures of places in the bottom of the ocean where the plates are separating and they have this hot water bubbling up, they call them smokers with different kinds of bacteria growing. And that brine got stuck on the bottom because it's hot water and the cold water pressure pushing down on it. Then over millions of years, all the stuff settles down, sediments, buries it. Then mountains build and bring that brine that's been turned into ore after being crushed by the deep ocean and the rocks on top of it. And it comes in building, mountain building, and then breaks open. And that's like what Red Dog is, for example. Yeah. It's a big ore body.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Torlach. I have Roman Dial with me in the studio talking about his research in the Arctic on rusted rivers and the new documentary called Arctic Alchemy. So, fascinating. And so, the rusted rivers, are they sulfuric? Are they like acidic?
Well, that's a great question. They're not that acidic. I mean, let's talk about what acidity means. So, acidity is on the pH scale, and water that we like to drink, you know, like a bottled water, has a pH of 7. That's considered neutral. So it's neither acidic nor basic. And basic would be, you know, like alkaline, and that has a high pH. And then a low pH is acid. So coffee, I think, has a pH of maybe 3 or 4, and battery acid is like 2. And anything, a pH less than 5 usually kills a lot of plants, you know. And so what these rivers, like the Alatna or the Salmon River, their pHs are actually relatively high, you know, like 7 or 8 even. Mm-hmm. But the little tributaries that are coming in, those have a very low pH. But it gets neutralized pretty quickly, but the metals are still there, you know. And then the acidity is bubbling up through the ground, this acid water, and it's dissolving aluminum, which usually isn't a sulfide. Like I don't know exactly where the aluminum came from, but it's in the soil. It's it's the most common element, I guess, you know, at least are the most common metal, I guess. And so that aluminum, the acid will kind of dissolve it and put it in the water, and then it stays in the water, and that's toxic to fish. It kind of gets into their gills and plates their gills and interferes with their respiration. So you don't really notice the acidity in the water. You notice these metals because the water gets pretty neutralized rapidly. I mean, you definitely see it in these acidic seeps. Like there are these acid seeps that bubble up from the permafrost, and then they create like a burn. Like they kill all the plants, and then the water, it looks like somebody torched it. And then it runs down to the creek, and the creek turns orange, and the river turns orange. And a lot of metals are in suspended particulate form, which means they're still floating around, even though like they form these kind of particles. You can't really see them, but you can see their color, but they're really small.
And so in the film, they're measuring, there's some emphasis on measuring pH. That's one reason I asked that.
I mean, here's the thing. Every TV show or every film is, you know, it's a story, you know?
Right.
And I do have to wince a little bit when I watch it because, you know, they've recorded us saying, oh, it's over 100, but we're actually looking at the iron concentration,
not the acid.
Yeah. I know. There's a lot of those little things. And, you know, I've learned over the years that, reporters never get everything right. You know, it's sort of like, I saw some movie once and it was like, I may have the facts wrong, but I got the feeling right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I thought it was well done. Let's talk about the filming a little bit. So now you're up there with the film crew. And I've done this a little bit. I have a background in adventure sports with film crews. How'd that go? Did they fit in your group? I've heard run a pretty tight ship and push people pretty hard. How'd they do?
Oh, they were amazing. I mean, I'd say that, they were, I've never been with a film crew that not only kept up, but basically always stayed ahead.
You know? Wow.
Yeah. And not only that, they never really made us redo anything.
Yeah.
They were true documentarians. And there were two filmmakers, a guy, Colin Arisman, who was the first one I met. And then he had kind of like a co-filmmaker named Zeppelin Zirip.
Nice name.
I know, isn't it?
Yeah.
And he's like 10 feet tall. And at first I thought, because I didn't know these guys, and I'm looking through their gear. I'm like, yeah, you've got too much stuff. And, I don't think you're really going to, I thought we'd be babysitting them, but no, not at all. And, and then they had a still photographer, a woman named Jamie Dittmar. And she was, I don't know if I can say that on the air, but she was a real badass too.
Yeah.
So these guys were amazing, and they'd run ahead through the tussocks and get us coming at them.
Oh,
they'd run to the top of a mountain. They ran along like a morainal ridgeline, kind of like we're in this little valley, kind of like a canyon. And they ran along the ridge, along the canyon rim to get these long shots at us as we were pack rafting down,
And it's one of my favorite shots in the movie, actually. You guys coming down the river like that. It was pretty awesome.
Yeah. And then they'd never pack rafted before, but they jumped right in. They were like, it was the best film crew I've ever worked with in my life. I'm a little sensitive. I don't really like to promote myself. People probably think I'm a big self-promoter, but I don't really think of myself as that. And so I'm a little hesitant to post things on Facebook about myself. But I did put this film up because they did such a great job and I'd like to help further their career because they're an amazing group.
Yeah. In the film, we'll get into some more of the content of the film. But I want to go back to the science stuff a little bit. You made a comment before we started interviewing about not being able to go out and not sort of look at things. You want to talk about that as a scientist? Like you're out in the field, you're always sort of looking and analyzing, I guess.
Oh, I'm stuck.
Yeah.
Right. that tree line work, which was basically walking in places that nobody had ever seen any trees before. 20 miles away from tree line and looking for little spruce seedlings in the tundra, basically, where, you don't expect to see them, but once you know they're there, you know to look for them. It's sort of like, I don't know if you've ever had this experience where you're with somebody and you're walking through a field and, maybe you're behind this person and that person stops and says, wow, look at this flower. And you've been walking through the field for, 10 or 15 minutes and they pick the flower and they turn around to you and they show you the flower. You go, wow, that is really a cool flower. And then you look at your feet, they're everywhere. You turn around and look and you've been walking through them for 10 minutes, but you hadn't seen them.
Yeah.
And so these spruce trees, as Ray Kalesser, who helped me a lot over the years, he's older than me, but he's a fantastic field worker. He said, people don't expect to see them, so they're not gonna see them. So we'd hike around looking for these little spruce seedlings. And I can't help myself. I see them all the time and everywhere I see them, even I went boating yesterday which I shouldn't have done, but I went out and I saw little seedlings. And now on any hike in the Brooks Range, you know, I use my phone, I take a picture of the little seedlings with my trekking pole to get its scale. And then if I find these acid seeps, you know, the phone is such a useful tool for collecting this kind of data, because all you really have to do is have some sort of like the Gaia app, you know, navigation app, and then the camera with its location data on, and you've got data.
Interesting. So into the to the film a bit. One of the things, one of my things that I like in the world is when the filmmakers asked the different crew members that describe Roman, right? And it's, I won't tell people what, you know, watch the film to see their answers. But how would you describe yourself?
Well, one thing that's kind of behind the scenes that I will sort of spoil is that, and it's not shown in the film, they asked everybody, what one word would you use to describe Roman?
You know,
and I know, and I don't, this will sound arrogant, you know, and I don't mean it that way, but I would have trouble describing myself in one word. So if I had to describe myself in one word, and I don't mean this like I'm not pounding my chest, but I would say I'm sort of indescribable.
Okay.
But mostly because, like, I don't know, like, what if you asked, you know, I it depends on what I'm sort of focused. Like right now I'd say, oh, I'm a scientist, but I'm not really a scientist, you know.
Right. Well, I think word that what came up was the idea of durability in your partners. So maybe that's a word to describe yourself.
I am fairly durable.
Like, yeah. You keep going.
Yeah, right?
You've been through a lot.
Yeah, that's a good word.
And talk about that word a little bit in finding partners, either research or tripwise.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I think, you know, people, what I'm looking for in an outdoor partner in terms of durability is physical and emotionally durable. You know, I'm not sure if mental durability comes in, but by physical, I mean they can put up with discomfort. You know, they can put on wet shoes every morning and not notice, you know, walk through wet brush that feels like you're in a car wash, or see a bear and not freak out, you know, cross a river and, you know, be willing to like go with the flow when it gets to be kind of deep.
Yeah.
And so that's physical durability. And then the emotional durability, I guess it's kind of related to that. Just being able to put up with me, for example, and put up with it with the conditions. So durability is something I do look for in partners.
You've been listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media, and I have Roman Dial in the studio with me, and we'll be right back after this break.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store, or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Tordot. We have Roman Dial in the studio with me. Roman, in some of this, in this documentary, we're talking about Arctic alchemy. They talk about the Dial style of research and maybe traveling through the wilderness. Explain what you think that is.
Dial style?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Dial style, I kind of feel like Forrest McCarthy sort of came up with that term. And I think in part, you know, it's his original interpretation or definition of that was that I was sort of applying the Wilderness Classic, which is this race that's been going on in Alaska for, I don't know, 40 years now, where, you know, you start in one place and you go to another place carrying all your own food and equipment. And that, you know, because we travel very light. You know, our tents have no floors. You know, we use wood a lot. We have pack rafts that we share, for example, and one group walks while the other group carries everybody's gear down the river. So there's that sort of how we travel Dial style. And then I think it's also morphed into how we plan or don't plan. You know, like we have an idea of what we're going to do, but it changes all the time. And that's because we're not, you know, it's not really goal oriented in like, oh, we've got to climb this peak or we have to run this river. It's more like we've got to get these data, you know, and figure out what's going on. And you can't really plan discovery. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
It has to happen on its own, and you need to use a little intuition.
Yep. So when you go on these research trips, Do you have a goal? Do you have like, okay, here's our plan. Like here's, we want to go to this particular river. And then, so where does that style of flexibility, when does that kick in?
Right. Okay, great. So I'll just use this river that's in the story, in the movie. So originally, you know, the plan was we'd float down the John River and then hike over a pass to the Kootuk River and then float down the Kootuk River, which is really like an amazingly disrupted stream. And it was one of the first ones to go out, and it's big. But it became, you know, pretty clear that we weren't going to have the time to do that because of a lot of things that came up that we couldn't plan around. And so instead, you know, we hiked up to these to a different creek, and I think we kind of made these decisions like on the fly. And then we found out, wow, this stream has pretty much everything we need to kind of document what's going on in this river valley. So just being flexible with your goals. So like there's the big picture, you know, like we're going to go to this watershed or actually this area, and then we might like hop over a pass to go in another way. But then you're like, oh, we can't do that. Well, let's do this. So yeah. It's that kind of flexibility, because it's not like, oh, we've got to run this river. And so if we're not in that river, we didn't run that river. Oh, we've got to climb this mountain. And if you're not on that mountain, I guess you didn't climb that mountain. But with the scientific aspect, you go where the science sort of dictates.
And was that a slow evolution for you? I mean, I think about your mountaineering career. Mm-hmm. Well, that's pretty goal-oriented. Or even the racing thing. It's a little goal-oriented also. So, or was that just, was that a deliberate decision? Like, oh, we're going to do this? Or was there a particular moment like, oh, we need to be more flexible?
Uh-huh. Yeah, so. Great question. Well, actually, in there was the flexibility started in that long distance racing, actually, you know, because those races required you to be flexible. You know, you'd come to a river and you thought you could wade it, but oh, no, you can't wade it there. You've got to, you know, blow up your pack raft, for example, or go farther upstream and walk around. So a lot of that, I would have to say that a lot of the joy that I get in sort of making decisions on the fly came from those long adventure races, you know, like the Eco Challenge and the Ray Galois and the Wilderness Classic. And I kind of liked that because you couldn't plan everything.
Yeah.
And you couldn't plan, like things would come up. You couldn't plan, like I don't do day bags of food. Like I don't, when I'm getting ready to do a trip, I don't, you know, fill a Ziploc bag. Here's day one and here's day two and here's day three. Because I can't plan on how much food I'm going to need on a given day. Some days I eat a lot and some days I don't eat much. So, it's been a slow evolution to the point where, like, I do remember it maybe at some point where if I thought too much about a trip, I didn't really want to go on it. Like if I was going to plan a trip and I started thinking about it in, you know, December, and I just planned it and studied it and looked at the map and, you know, started working on my food, you know, come June, I was like, I'd already done it in my head. I don't really want to go. And so now, you know, I kind of like the idea of just picking up stuff and going.
And do you think that, well, obviously nature, like weather, like, that sort of forces flexibility.
Oh, totally. Yeah. And wilderness is, that's what wilderness is about, is not being able to anticipate what's going to happen. I mean, nature is that way.
Yeah.
So, I like that aspect. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's one of the best lessons I get out of nature all the time, is I can't control things and I just got to work with it, whatever's been thrown at me.
Right. Yeah. Even with river crossings, like,
yeah.
Like I, you know, I like river crossings, you know,
yeah,
like,
yeah, me too.
And, and I feel like they're the kind of thing sometimes you just have to go with the flow, you know, you can't fight it, you know, you can't just turn upstream and, you know, muscle your way across. You kind of have to ferry, you know, on foot.
Right,
and,
yeah.
And so, same with weather. Like if the weather's bad, I guess I'm going to hang out in the tent and do something else, because I'm not going to be able to collect data that day.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about challenges a bit. In the film, talk about why you do some of this. And you mentioned that the idea of overcoming challenges is a big attraction to you. Talk about that.
Sure. Well, life is full of challenges. You know, I mean, there's normal life. I guess like right now you and I are in normal life or real life. I'm not sure what to call it exactly.
In a radio studio, I'm not sure what it is, but yeah.
And there's a lot of challenges in everyday life, let's say, and how you deal with those, or at least how I deal with those, is often informed by my experiences in the outdoors or in nature. And when I was young, like a teenager, 20s, the challenge of climbing was really appealing, you know, because it was challenging to have to face my fear or my disappointment or the difficulty I was having with a partner. And because like when you're in, you know, on a mountain and there's just the two of you and you're not getting along, you have to figure out how to deal with that. And that's a challenge. And, yep. You know, picking a route, getting down off of a mountain, that's a challenge. And I got a lot of, confidence maybe would be the word, confidence in myself in the sense that, okay, well, back in real life, if something happens, I can deal with this. You know, I'm not going to freak out. I'm going to kind of try to be calm and think this through and do what I need to do. Or like if I have to give a talk and get up in front of people, which is kind of scary, it's a challenge. But I'm like, I can use the same sorts of skills that I learned, you know, in the outdoors. I guess a lot of athletes, you know, world-class athletes who are like Olympians, you know, they go on to like fantastic business careers. And I think a lot of times the people skills and sort of their own management of their emotions came from their athletic experiences. And I'm not really an athlete. And I don't
know about that, but yeah.
well, thanks. But I feel like this in sort of in congruence to that, what I learn in the wilderness when I'm challenged, because the wilderness is always challenging, pretty much, you know? And even when it's hot and sunny in the Brooks Range, it's a challenge.
It can be a real challenge for those of us who aren't used to it.
Yeah. And so that just gives me the strength and if you will, the emotional durability to come back to, you know, normal life.
And I think that's, I really can relate to the confidence thing, especially as a teenager, like being in the outdoors gave me like confidence. Oh, if I can do this. And sometimes it's uncomfortable, it's miserable, it's maybe a little life-threatening, and that like it's serious. And it once you've successfully navigated all that, going back and talking to in front of a bunch of people is like, I'm not going to die doing this. Hopefully no one's going to shoot me or whatever. Like it's going to be manageable, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly it.
Now, you've been through some big challenges in your life, losing your son being one, and that's you've written a book about it, The Adventure of Son, and we've had a whole show about this, and you've talked about it. And it's a theme in the film, also one of the many themes in a 30-minute film, which is pretty impressive that they got it all in there. Talk about how wilderness has helped you cope with that particular incident and others in your life.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, I feel like whenever something really, if I have some challenges, if I go out into the wilderness, and by the wilderness, you know, I mean places that don't really have trails. You know, for me, I like being off trail, and I think perhaps, the simplest way to describe it would be I'm distracted. You know, I've got this sort of something that's bothering me. And then if I'm like having to make a decision about like which way to go through the brush or how to cross a river or get across a talus slope, you know, I'm focused on that and I'm not thinking about whatever it is that's kind of bumming me out. You know, I mean, that would be maybe the simplest way to look at it. And another way to look at it is that, you know, when I'm out there in a bigger world, I can kind of see that, you know, my problems are small and that the rest of the world, it's not that they don't care about my problems, but they're not a part of the bigger world, if you will, you know, and that's helpful to me. Like
puts you in a place a little bit.
It does. It puts you in place. Yeah. And it's kind of like, I'm not really a religious, I mean, I have prayed to God a few times when I felt like I needed that. You know, I don't go to church. You know, I do believe that there's something a lot more than we know that's going on. And somehow when I'm out there, I feel closer to that. And it gives me sort of, not power isn't the right word. And it's not really confidence, but peace maybe, you know, joy sometimes.
And let's go down that road a little bit like that, whatever you want to call it, spiritual, sort of that feeling of some, you, being in the places without trails, do you feel that more?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Especially.
And why do you think that is? Yeah.
Well, because the humans right now they're everywhere. You know, they're everywhere, and somehow we think that we're the end all, be all. And even like there's some of the people who seem to be the strongest believers in some greater being are actually like really focused on people as the end all, be all. Like it's kind of weird.
Yeah.
But when you go to a place, and there's so few of these places left in the world where you can stand on top of a mountain and look around and not see any sign of humans, or you can fly in an airplane. Like when you fly across the lower 48, I mean, everybody knows this, you fly across the lower 48, you never see but like maybe a little island of some forest or wilderness down there, and the rest of it is, you know, human-impacted landscapes.
Yep.
But when you come to Alaska and you fly over, you're like, you don't really see any human impact. And when you're on foot and walking and pushing yourself through the mud and the brush and the rivers and the scree, you know, it makes you feel kind of, not exactly small isn't the right word, but an insignificant isn't the right word, because I don't want to focus on me, but it makes you realize that the world is really big, and it's, there's a lot more to the world than just humans. And I think that right now in the 21st century, we have the last chance to kind of preserve this really big wilderness, because once it's gone, you don't really get it back. So like this Ambler Road, I mean, I understand the problems that people in the villages have economically, you know, but mines run out and then jobs go away. And if you've lost your natural resources that you've depended on, well, where are you then? You know, because all these communities, they can't afford to fly stuff in to live on their food. It's too expensive, you know, especially the way politics are going now. They're going to make it even more expensive to get stuff out there. So they need those resources that are out there. So anyway, I don't know how I got there, but I feel that we need, for humanity's sake, to preserve the last of the big wilderness. Like Yosemite and Yellowstone and the Grand Canyon, they were like the first national parks because they were so wondrous. And they were just wondrous places in big wilderness back then in the 1800s. And people thought, yeah, we need to keep this out of the corporate hands. We need this to be for the people. And then through the 20th century, we got all the other national parks that were really amazing places. And all those amazing places are kind of set aside, but all we have now for the 21st century to protect are these, the last of the big wilderness, and we should do what we can because we need those, you know, for our emotional well-being and also for the health of the environment of other organisms to be able to migrate as the climate changes.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm Roman Dial. We're talking about his work in the Arctic. I think that sort of, and also I would say from a scientific perspective, that there's so much we don't know about the natural world. And it's almost like the cliche, the more we learn, the less we know. And that preserving these areas would you agree with that? That's an important reason to have some of these areas.
Oh, yeah.
From a scientific perspective.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, from a scientific perspective. But I am also sensitive to the fact that, you know, the science we do, and this is something that's changed over my lifetime, you know, like I'm trying to focus, not trying, but I'm drawn more to science that addresses human needs in rural Alaska. So this water
thing. Yep.
The water, and I really wanted to work on caribou. Like that was my last proposal that I submitted, was for caribou work, because so many communities depend on the Western Arctic caribou herd.
Yeah.
And I really wanted to try to understand why that's declining and why their migration has changed, where they, you know, where they stay the winter and where they calve is still kind of the same place. But because so many communities depend on that. And anyway, yeah, I think science is really important to have wild areas so that we have like a control. But Alaska is sort of unique in that we have a lot of communities who depend on what wilderness is producing. Like they're part of the wilderness, you know, like I know wilderness is supposed to be a place where there are no people, but I think true wilderness has people that are part of it.
Yeah, and in your travels in the Arctic, I will say it's been a lot, like somewhat, you said 7,000 miles in the just in the Brooks Range?
Yeah, 7,000 miles. I guess, like I would throw that ice skating trip I did with Luke Mell, which was technically not, well, definitely not in the Brooks Range, but it was in the Arctic.
Right, yeah,
yeah. So I'd say it really is more like, and we rode fat bikes along the coast from Point Hope down to Shoshalik, which is right across from Kotzebue, and that's not really in the Brooks Range. It goes right on the edge of the Brooks Range. But yeah, 7,000 miles north of the Arctic Circle would be closer to the truth.
In those travels then, you probably saw signs of humans. I mean, people have been there for thousands and thousands of years.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So is that part of your, did that influence you, like in your interest in this sort of human connection with wilderness? Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure. We've found artifacts. Yeah, of course, and we've seen signs of like old mining stuff. But I'm actually, it's more the people who are there now.
Right.
You know, like
I guess that's what I was talking about.
You run into, an Inupiaq couple, you know, upriver with a boat, and you know they're happy to help. Or they want to hear your story, and you want to hear them. And there's something about those people who are still living on the land and close to the land. It's so unique in the world. It's sort of heartbreaking to see that go away.
Yeah. Yeah. And the challenges they have right now with the effects of climate change.
Yeah. Like, look what happened in Western Alaska. You know, like all those people got pushed out by
the latest remnant typhoon. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very sad. So that leads me to the next thing. Sort of this idea, you have a quote in there about humanity's been around a lot longer than civilization. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, sure. You know, I mean, I don't know exactly how to define civilization. I mean, we could talk about, the written word or agriculture, but humans go beyond, back farther than 3,000 years. And for me, humanity, being humanity, like that's kind of like those, the feeling you have when you're with other people, like in the outdoors, and you know, it's just you, your little group, yep. And how you have to get along and how you have to rely on each other and just engage with, that's a really old feeling. You know, that's super old. And I feel like, you know, most people need a chance to experience that, because that's kind of what being a human is, like a human animal.
Yeah. And I want to go back and sort of transition from there to the idea of risk. Mm-hmm. And that somehow when we're out there, we're, it's perceived risk, like people think it's risky. How's that enable that feeling? Of being an animal. Basically.
Okay, well, that's a really, we talk about that for a long time. So let's just talk about like risk when you're, in your 20s, because that's where you're kind of most, at least I was, and I've looked around, most open to the idea of being in a risky situation, yeah. You know? And by risky, I mean maybe life-threatening. And I feel that basically being part of a human animal is that's kind of where you prove yourself to yourself and to your kind of group, I killed a bear with my spear. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. That's risky.
That's risky. Yeah, I wouldn't do that.
But people did that, Yeah. And then it kind of proved to the rest of the, tribe, that this person was brave and they could handle pressure. You know, and I think that it's part of that going to the wilderness to sort of experience challenges. That's kind of what risk, that's the flip side. The challenge is dealing with some sort of a risk, I'd say.
Yeah.
And so a risk of failure or a risk of injury or even a risk of death. And I think that goes very far back in our human DNA to kind of, determine how we're going to get along with other people and how we're going to interact with the environment in a way that allows us to survive.
Yeah. And there must be something attractive to that to some people, like a lot of listeners to this show and you and I, but not everybody.
Right. Well, it's with like art. Like some people, we all have a little bit of creativity inside of us, but some people are like amazing or athleticism. We all can jump, but some people can jump really high, And so there's a broad spectrum of being, there's many axes of being a human, and we're all sort of on different places on those axes. And so risk tolerance is one of those axes.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier the idea of the adventure drug, right? Like, and as a youth, and you're talk about your progression with that a little bit, like, because that sort of falls in the same thing, like you have this, you look at whether the adrenaline, you have this risk, and then you sort of want more of it. Mm-hmm. But now we're sort of ending that part of our lives, maybe. Talk about that arc.
Sure, that arc. Bit. Yeah. Well, you know, when you're a kid, you're afraid of stuff. We're born with a bunch of fears. Like, we are born with a fear of the dark, fear of heat, fear of big animals, fear of snakes and spiders, fear of water, you know, fear of cold, fear of heat. And then as we mature. Because all those fears are built into that, what I call the lizard brain. I don't know all the anatomy of the brain. I'm just going to call like this.
The amygdala.
Is that it? The amygdala? Yeah, okay, yeah. So that thing is all hardwired. It's like when you buy a computer and you got an operating system already on there, you haven't put any apps on. Well, that's what we come with. That's our hardwiring is that. Because that's what you need to stay alive. You got to be afraid of those things and recoil so that you're not going to like die. And then as we age, we realize, you know, with the human brain, the big brain that's wrapped around that amygdala, we realize that we don't have to be scared all the time, that there's sometimes we don't have to worry. Then we find out that we can expose ourselves to those fears and the amygdala. And this is me just making this stuff up. I don't know if it's true.
You're doing pretty good, I think.
Okay. Yeah. So that lizard brain, it goes, uh-oh. You know, you're in trouble, and maybe it fires off the adrenaline hormone. And I don't really like adrenaline. It makes me kind of edgy. But then you survive, and then I think that amygdala, something releases this other drug, chemical hormone, that makes you feel good. Like, wow, we just survived. Yeah. And that's the reward for you just did whatever you should have done, okay? That's your body saying, good job. Like, here's a piece of candy. You did a good job. Yeah. When you're in this situation, do that again. So you survive. And then that human brain goes, hey, I know how to like get a quick hit of feeling good. I just scare myself.
Yeah.
Now, unlike other drugs, you can become addicted to that. And I feel like I was addicted to like scaring myself. And there's a lot of young men out there, especially young men, I don't mean to be sexist, a lot of amazing young men out there who are scaring themselves because it feels so good. And they're going up on big mountains and they're really talented guys and they're not dying from, you know, like their ability to climb. They're dying from like, you know, an avalanche hitting them when they didn't see it coming, or falling out of their tent, hanging on a big wall. And so that drug we're after, it's different than alcohol. You know, it's different than, you know, I don't know, not that I know much about cocaine or meth or any of the others, but those drugs, you become addicted to true drugs, and then you quit, and then you're sober. But if you pick them up again, you're back in it. It's hard to get sober again. Yep. Whereas this adventure drug, and I've been struggling with this idea for a while, but this adventure drug is one that you can drop it and you don't have to really pick it up again. Like you can go like boating. Okay, I'll just give an example. You know, I was a whitewater addict all through my 50s, and I'd given it up because I could feel me losing my edge, and I gave it up. And then I went boating yesterday, and I was like, oh, yeah, I remember this feeling. Oh, this is good. My amygdala was firing off those little rewards for feeling afraid and then getting over it. But then something happened that was rather hazardous, and I was like, yeah, I want to get out of here. I don't need to do this anymore.
Done.
Yeah, I'm done. You know, it's not like I fell off the wagon and I had a drink, and I'm like, oh, yeah, I like this. I'm going to keep drinking.
Yeah.
So fortunately, I think, you know, the human body, our DNA, it that amygdala it's not a truly addictive drug.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel the same way. I think the older we get, hopefully the wiser we get. We've got a couple minutes left. So we're talking with Roman Dial, and they got a new documentary, mostly about Roman and his research and his life, called Arctic Alchemy, available at the LA Times Shorts webpage to stream. But part of this document is about passing the torch on the younger scientist. In a couple minutes, like, how's that feel? And yeah.
Well, sure. Yeah, you know, I am a parent. You know, I have a daughter who's, I guess she's, let me see, 36.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then we had a son, and he died in 2014 in an accident in the jungle where I think a tree fell on him, or he got bit by a snake. Not quite clear. And I really, you know, both me with my son and my wife with our daughter, we really liked doing things with our kids that we like to do. We like to share them, and we like to, you know, as you say, kind of pass the torch, you know, and yeah. It's really cool to see our daughter, you know, she's very, like, not so much artistic, but she does, like, really cool craft type things, you know, like she doesn't draw or paint, but she makes really cool, you know, I forget what it's called, quilling. Then she also is a really good baker. Like she makes these macaron cookies that you like, they look like they came, you know, from, you know, the finest French finest French bakery. And so anyway, we like passing things on to young people. That's part of being a human animal, you know? And so having lost my son, you know, maybe I'm a little embarrassed to admit it, but I've found a lot of satisfaction in going out into the wilderness and with these young people and showing them the wilderness. And then also, like, you know, like with Russell Wong, passing on the idea of doing science out there. You know, it's very satisfying, like just that's as totally a human animal, you know?
Yeah, that's super fair. And Russell's going on to get his PhD and following your footsteps, hopefully.
Yeah.
Thanks, Roman. It's been wonderful. This has been Outdoor Explorer, and I've had Roman Dial with me in the studio.
Thank you, Paul. Oh, it was a real pleasure. Thank you, Paul.
Thanks to my guest, Roman Dial. A link to the film, Arctic Alchemy, is on the Outdoor Explorer webpage. Roman also has a series of discussions at the Anchorage Museum the first Tuesday of every month, titled The Outdoor Adventure Series. Also thanks to our producer, Tobin Shelby, with additional help from Amon Swenson. I'm your host, Paul Tordock, and from all the hosts of Outdoor Explorer, explore nature and we'll see you outdoors.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.